Well, hi everyone, welcome to December. Wow, it's insane to even say that word, but here we are, okay? So my question is, does everybody have that thing in your house that you've never fixed? Like at first it was bugging you, but then you just kind of got used to it being broken. For me, it's a doorknob on the hall closet that never quite got installed. So that closet is in not a very well-trafficked area in our home, so it's no big deal. But it just sits there with an open hole in the door where the knob is supposed to go through. And occasionally someone will try to use the door, but there's no doorknob to open it. And so I say, yeah, you just need to, stick your finger in that circular hole in there, and then you bend your fingers in there and where the little latch is supposed to go, and then pull out and the door will open right up. Well, you probably have something like that in your house or your apartment or your car, right? You don't even notice it anymore. Because you see, if something stays broken long enough, we stop noticing. And that's fine when it comes to small household repairs. But it's not fine when it comes to the brokenness in our world. And for this very reason, the prophets were sent in the Old Testament. People got lulled into apathy by their own comfort, and they stopped noticing the brokenness, the dysfunction. They stopped noticing the sin. And so the prophets were given both this blessing and a curse of looking at the world and seeing what God sees. They saw all the brokenness and feeling what God feels. And they saw that rich people were trying to get richer and looking the other way while poor people died. And sinful people were acting like there was nothing wrong with their lives when they're the source of their own problems. And we don't want to notice these broken pieces because that would make us uncomfortable. And our personal comfort has become like a sedative that lulls and dulls our awareness of true needs that are all around us. We don't want anybody to remind us about human misery and poverty and unwanted children waiting for adoption and gun violence and immigration crises and homelessness, because these are like that broken doorknob. They're here, but we just don't want to notice them anymore. And when they're brought to our attention, we give our simple, uninformed opinions that fit our existing biases, and then we move on with our lives. But the prophets, they saw the brokenness and they noticed. That was their gift. That was their burden. But they noticed. Well, one of those prophets was named Micah. He understood the heart of God. And in our text today in Micah 6:8, he tries to help us to notice too. He says these words, famous words. He says, "He has shown you, O man, what is good and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God." Act justly, love mercy, walk humbly. That's how we begin to notice. Now, it's important to understand some context here, and so we're going to get to that in just a moment, but I also need to explain that we're going to talk about these three components of this verse over the next 3 weeks, but we're going to do it out of order. And this week, I'm going to begin with the very last phrase that says, walk humbly with your God, because I believe that it provides a kind of foundation for the other two. That the only way that we can properly act justly in our world and the only way that we can authentically love mercy is when we're walking humbly with our God, which leads me to today's big idea, that we have to fix what's inside before we fix what's outside. You see, proper engagement with the needs of our world and the crises of our times, they begin with humility, this inside thing. And so during this month, in the midst of the hustle and bustle and spoiling our kids and office parties, we're going to provide some clear and practical next steps that we can take as a church and as individuals in dealing with some of the presenting issues of compassion and justice in our culture today, those broken things that we stop noticing. Because the call of Christianity, the call of the prophets of the Old Testament, are a call to action and not emotion. But here's what has happened in our day. We've replaced righteous indignation over sin with social media outrage on trendy topics of the day from behind our screens. And there's a lot of shouting but no doing. There's a lot of angst but no action. And so let me remind us today that God never called us to just react emotionally, but he called us to act compassionately. Shane Claiborne of The Simple Way in Philadelphia says it this way. He says, so often the biggest obstacle to God for people has been Christians. Christians who have had so much to say with our mouths and so little to show with our lives. And he says, I'm sorry that so often we have forgotten the Christ of our Christianity. And so this month, let's get back to the basics. You know, it's helpful when the Bible gives a clear, succinct description of God's expectations. And this verse in Micah 6:8 has been called a one-line summary of the whole of God's law, God's agenda for us in three simple phrases: do justly, love mercy, walk humbly with your God. But what led Micah to coin these three important commands? I mean, let's talk about Micah for a second. He was a country prophet in the 8th century BC. He was calling for a return to faithfulness from Israel in the north and from Judah in the south. Remember, we talked a few weeks ago in our marriage series about the importance of the concept of covenant in the Bible. Well, here Micah is calling the people of God back to faithfulness, to that covenant. And there are some of you here today, listen, who need to hear a similar call. Maybe you've walked away from God in big ways or small ways. Maybe the circumstances of your life have caused you to turn your back on God in your actions, or maybe your words, or maybe your attitudes. And Israel had turned away from the covenant, and so Micah, very creatively, he frames this chapter 6 in his book as a courtroom in which God is basically suing Israel for a breach of contract. He's bringing charges against them for violations on their end of the covenant. And so you need to imagine a courtroom scene with a judge and a jury and some witnesses, a defendant, a victim, a prosecuting attorney. And so the judge in this case is played by the prophet Micah, and he begins the trial. And he calls God, who is the prosecuting attorney, to make his case. And so verse 1 of chapter 6 of Micah starts like this. It says, "Stand up, plead your case before the mountains. Let the hills hear what you have to say." And so the mountains and the hills are both the witnesses and the jury. They're objective. You can't bribe mountains. And like a surveillance camera, they never sleep. They've seen the whole thing unfold. And so verse 2 says, "Hear you mountains, the Lord's accusation. Listen, you everlasting foundations of the earth, for the Lord has a case against his people." He's lodging a charge against Israel. And so the actual charges aren't listed here next, but they're found elsewhere in Micah and later in chapter 6. But they include things like dishonest business practices, oppression of the poor, lying, and idolatry. But the scene now takes a turn, and instead of listing the actual charges, God's demeanor changes from accusations to love, and his role changes from prosecutor to victim. He can't believe his people have treated him this way because of all he's done for them, and he's loved them. And listen to God's pleading for his people to remember his love. Verse 3 says, "My people, what have I done to you? How have I burdened you? Answer me. I brought you up out of Egypt and redeemed you from the land of slavery. I sent Moses to lead you, also Aaron and Miriam." And God is saying here, "How could you turn on me after all that I've done for you? I've been faithful to the covenant, but you haven't been faithful to me." Now again, some of you are in this same place. And so it comes time for the defendant to speak. Israel responds to God's accusations. And it has this confessional tone. Israel is acknowledging that they have fallen away and they want to come back to God. Look at verse 6. It says, "With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings or with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of olive oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul?" You see, they realize their guilt and they start asking the question, "So what do we have to do to make this right? What does God require of us?" And they conclude that it must be some sort of religious activity. It must include things like bowing down or offering burnt offerings of animals and oil, maybe even their firstborn child. But their response represents an incomplete understanding of a life with God. You see, we have a problem when we reduce our life with God to religious activities and we ignore how we are actually living. Religious practices are not bad or wrong, but they're detestable to God if we're also not loving God and neighbor. You see, God's on to us. He's on to our superficiality. He knows that we can make ourselves look spiritual on the surface while our underlying behaviors don't change. He's never satisfied with our rituals and our liturgies when our hearts remain corrupt. And so we have to fix what's inside first. Remember our big idea? And so the verdict in the courtroom of chapter 6 is issued, and God's demands are made clear. He says it's not the sacrifices or the rams or the calves or the oil and the altar that I want, I want your heart to reflect my heart as you walk through your everyday life. I don't require all the other stuff, but here's what I do require. And so we come to our verse that says, he's shown you, oh man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? Here's what's required: to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. To act justly simply means to make wrong things right. God wants you and I, when we see something that's unjust or not right, to work to make it right. It's part of our Christian responsibility. To love mercy simply means to love people beyond what they deserve. That's to be merciful. In your day-to-day, week-to-week life, have you given any thought to these things? Have you given any thought to your calling to make wrong things right, to love people beyond what they deserve? That's what we're called to. And that's why we've called this series the 6-8 Assignment, because I believe that God is going to use this month to assign each one of us an act of justice or compassion that we're supposed to step into. The assignment's not for anyone else, but it's for you. We're going to ask this question this December: what's my assignment? Because it's not just your church attendance. It's not your giving offerings or taking communion that defines your faith. It's how you walk through your day-to-day life and how you interact with the world around you that's important. And so this passage seems to give us some guidance when it comes to interacting with the world around us. It leads us to an important question: how should Christians approach culture? Now, historically, Christians have gravitated to one of four approaches. The first is this: to adapt to the culture. Some Christians have taken the approach that says, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. And when it comes to the world, they just engage in day-to-day activities and thought processes that make them completely indistinguishable from the people around them who have nothing to do with Jesus or the church. They just blend in. And so there's no difference in the substances they use, in the entertainment they expose themselves to, in the language that they choose, in the daily habits that they engage in. There's no difference in the way they run their businesses, in the way they approach their work, in their attitude towards family, in the way they handle their money, in the health of their marriages, in their approach to gossip and slander. And they just go along with the larger tide of culture. And they say, well, this is just what everyone else is doing, so I'm just going to float along with the tide. They adapt to culture. And sadly, when it comes to the crux of today's passage, in terms of justice and mercy, many Christians are actually lagging behind their non-Christian counterparts. Maybe some of their secular friends and family members are more compassionate to the poor and to the marginalized in our society than some Christians, even though historically the church has been the leader in almost every instance of compassion and justice ministries: orphanages, schools, medical clinics, hospitals, recovery groups, crisis centers, homeless shelters, rescue ministry. They've almost all been initiated by Christians because of their faith in Jesus. And yet many modern Christians have abandoned this Christian distinctive. So many Christians live their day-to-day lives in such a way that they're indistinguishable from the people around them. They've forgotten Jesus' words that say, we are to be in, but not of, this world. We are called to be part of this world and yet remain uncorrupted by its influence, holy and separate and set apart. The second approach to culture is this: to reject the culture. There are some Christians who do just the opposite. They pick every battle available to them and they declare war on culture. And everything that happens in the news goes into the category of our country's going to hell in a handbasket. And if we're not careful, this kind of thinking leads us to become conspiracy theorists, or maybe ultimately to become so frustrated that we give up and we disengage from the culture altogether. And instead of choosing their battles, some Christians see everything as a battle. So a recent example is this dumb Starbucks cup thing. They made their cups red, but they didn't include the words Christmas on them. And so a pastor makes a video screaming about the fact that this is another example of the war on Christmas and Christian persecution in our country. And the video gets millions of views and shares all over social media. Or everything that President Obama says is twisted to feed this battle cry. Or the decorations at Target are part of the plot against us. And don't let anyone take our guns. And there's this militant, anti-cultural tone that has led some Christians to view this world as the enemy. in a world where our Christian brothers and sisters wait with bended knees and clenched eyes for their heads to roll down sandy Libyan beaches, American Christians need to reconsider our definition of persecution, guys. In fact, we're here to be salt and light to this world, to bring hope and peace to this world, and not to reject it or declare war against it or hide from the very culture that God has sent us to reach. And some modern extremes are this Westboro Baptist group that sees everything as a fight and an opportunity to picket and spew hate. And on the other end of the spectrum, the Amish, who've rejected culture so much that they just formed their own little culture within it. But it's interesting to note that Jesus and Paul, they never got drawn into the culture wars, as easy as it would have been for them. I mean, Jesus' disciples, they were looking for a political takeover. And while Peter was busy slicing up Jesus' enemies, Jesus was busy reattaching their ears. The Apostle Paul had much to say about the immorality of individual church members, but very little to say about the political and social immorality of pagan Rome, the culture around him. He didn't rail about the abuses in Rome like slavery and idolatry and gladiator games and political oppression and greed, even though these things certainly must have offended Christians of that day, every bit as much as our deteriorating society offends Christians today. No, the answer is not to reject culture or to wage war against culture. There's a third approach, that is to rule the culture. Some people think that the answer is to get enough Christians elected or to get enough legislation passed that we can rule the culture, but I want to propose that this isn't the answer either. In fact, history shows that when Christianity was the law of the land, it became all too easy to exchange the law of grace for the temptation of power. Back in the Middle Ages, Christianity ruled the culture. Christians appointed key political leaders, and Christian faith permeated all of the popular culture. And yet, crusaders devastated lands to the east. Priests marching alongside soldiers converted whole continents at the point of a sword. Inquisitors hounded Jews, hunted down witches, even subjected loyal Christians to cruel tests of faith. When the church became the moral police of society, grace always gave way to power. When the church was setting the rules for all society, it veered toward the kind of extremism that Jesus warned against. Consider one example. John Calvin is one of the most revered theologians in Christian history. Many of you here would consider yourselves Calvinists in your theology. And yet, when John Calvin was given an experiment to lead the first overtly Christian city in Geneva, Switzerland, and to basically run a city like a church where all the laws were based on religion and the church was in charge of education and the social sector and every, you know, even a specially created ecclesiastical court, the city before long took a frightening and ineffective turn. Church attendance was mandatory. Laws started to cover such issues as to how many dishes could be served at each meal and the appropriate colors of garments people could wear. A woman whose hairdo reached an immoral height spent 4 days in jail. In separate incidents, and even some of Calvin's close relatives, they were executed when they were caught in acts of adultery. It didn't work. There are similar and more modern examples in Ireland and Spain and Latin America that have all gone to show that religion that is allied too closely to the state leads to an abuse of power. Christian experiments with church-state blending, they inevitably provoke a backlash against the church. So one takeaway from these examples is a reminder that the gospel grows best from the bottom up rather than being imposed from the top down. And that the church and the government are incompatible bedfellows. Now, this isn't just a Christian problem. The 20th century saw the tyranny of atheistic regimes that imprisoned and killed tens of millions of people. They censored art, literature, and music and tortured citizens in an attempt to get them to change their beliefs. The moral police in Cambodia, the Red Guards in China, they persecuted people for the crimes of wearing eyeglasses, possessing money, or having a college degree. Right? My point is that when Christianity enters the game of trying to rule the culture, it doesn't work. It doesn't help the culture, and it doesn't help the church. And so Jesus always positioned himself at a safe distance from the cries of his followers to take over the political reins of his day. And he set himself and his movement up as the bringers of a countercultural move of compassion and justice. Now, I'm not saying to avoid the political process. By all means, vote your conscience. By all means, run for office if you are so called. But be careful about any idea that the hope of this world lies in the kingdoms of this world, because that's a misplaced hope. The fourth option is this: redemptively engage the culture. This is what I believe we're called to do. Christians are called into the culture to help God to do his restorative work. We're not called to compromise our faith and to fully just embrace everything the culture does, but we're not called to reject it either. And we're not called to rule over the culture, but we are called to follow in the footsteps of Jesus and Paul and the words of Micah 6:8 to be a redemptive influence as we engage the world around us. Now, how do we do that? I think there's three things that will help us. First, we must celebrate what's admirable in culture. Where we see instances of godly principles at work, whether they're the result of overtly Christian groups or not, we need to celebrate that. And so when we see teachers who are serving and teaching our children, when we see social agencies who are helping the marginalized, when we see policies that are, you know, helping to equal the playing field for racial and gender inequalities, we should be celebrating these things. We should also engage the culture when we work to restore what is broken or dysfunctional. We put our shoulder to the plow when we see evidence of violent crime and divorce and youth suicide and drug use and children on welfare and illegitimate births. Do you realize that the United States outranks every other industrialized country in those issues that I just mentioned? So we must demonstrate grace and love and come to the table with real solutions to those problems if we're going to truly engage. And finally, we must stand against what's evil in our culture. I fully support the right and indeed the responsibility of Christians to get involved in being a prophetic voice in our culture. Early Christians were instrumental in ending cruel Roman practices like gladiator games and infanticide. And ever since, Christians have led moral campaigns against abuses such as slavery and civil inequalities and abortion. But I would contend that we will be ineffective standing against what is evil until we've effectively celebrated what is admirable and restored what is broken. Because the truth is that the Bible is clear that our faith must include this kind of redemptive engagement in the life of every Christian, especially in our response to the poor and the marginalized. You might recall Jesus' words in Matthew 25. They describe the final judgment where Jesus is dividing humanity into two camps, the sheep and the goats, those who go to heaven and those who go to hell. And what's interesting, as Richard Stearns notes in his book, A Hole in Our Gospel, that the criterion for dividing up these two groups is not that the sheep confessed faith in Christ while the goats did not, but rather that the sheep had acted in tangible and loving ways toward the poor and the sick and the imprisoned and the vulnerable, while the goats did not. Those whose lives were characterized by acts of love done to the least of these were blessed and welcomed by Christ into his Father's kingdom, and those who ignored the least of these were rejected. Why? Because the passage tells us that Christ himself is the least of these. A modern translation of the passage would go something like this: "For I was hungry while you had all you needed. I was thirsty while you drank bottled water. I was a stranger and you wanted me deported. I needed clothes, but you needed more clothes. I was sick and you pointed out the behaviors that led to my sickness. I was in prison and you said I was getting what I deserved." Now, I want to be clear that this doesn't mean that we're saved somehow by piling up enough good works to get into heaven. No, it means that any genuine commitment to Christ will be accompanied by actions toward the needy and toward the ignored that give evidence of our transformed lives. Act justly, love mercy, walk humbly with your God. See, it's important to remember that everything God asks of us flows out of who God is. Everything he asks of us is a reflection of his character. So why should we act justly? Well, because God is absolutely just and he's committed to justice. Why should we love mercy? Well, because God is mercy. Why are we invited to walk humbly with God? Because God surrendered himself to us. It is in his nature to sacrifice himself on our behalf. And so demonstrating justice and mercy, they're outward behaviors, but they flow from this inward reality of walking humbly with God. And so whatever we do as we engage our culture around us, we must do it out of the overflow of a humble heart. And often when it comes to matters of justice, I see Christians yelling. I see Christians being self-righteous. I see closed-mindedness and an unwillingness to engage in civil dialogue with people who disagree. But I don't often see humility overflowing from their hearts to their mouths. And so I want to conclude today by talking about what it means to walk humbly with your God. Remember, the command is to walk, not to run. And walking just reminds us that we live in a day-to-day continuous relationship with God, and that we walk humbly. Humility is just the opposite of arrogance. It's the opposite of foolishness. It's the attitude that says, I still have plenty to learn. Did you ever notice that it's the people who think that they have it all figured out who are the most difficult to work with? Well, how does humility help us to engage the culture around us? There are two truths about humility that I think will help us in this area. They come from Pastor Jason Strand from Minnesota. The first truth that keeps us humble is this: to remember that everything I have comes from God. Any wisdom, any strengths, any advantages, any opportunities that you or I have been given, He's the one that created them. He's the one that made my life. He's the one that ordains my steps. 1 Corinthians 4:7 says it this way: what do you have that you did not receive? If then you received it, why do you boast as if you did not receive it? You see, you could have been born somewhere else. I mean, it's humbling just to realize that my education is better than 99% of the world. I didn't create my brain, my hands. I didn't choose my skin color, my chiseled physique. I chose none of that. I could have been born in Zimbabwe. I could have had no education. I could have had physical deformities. Despite the fact that I know that's true in my head, there are many times I give myself credit for these things, and pride starts to creep in. The second truth that keeps us humble is that success has little to do with what I have and more to do with how I use what I've been given. You know, there are people all over this earth who have all the appearances of earthly success who are not successful at all in the eyes of God. It's what we do with what we've been entrusted with that determines our success in this life. And these two truths are going to help to produce humility in us. Because when you compare, you always lose. You're either going to look around and say, oh man, they're so skinny, or they're so wealthy or successful, and you'll be discouraged and you'll lack gratitude. Or you're going to look at them and see that they're worse off than you in those areas, and you're going to be filled with pride. You see, when you compare to others, you always lose. And here's the thing about pride. If you're filled with pride, you're never going to be able to act justly, and you're never going to be able to love mercy. You won't be able to see the world through your own arrogance and self-righteousness. And here's the other thing about pride. James 4:6 says, God opposes the proud. He gives grace to the humble. Jesus put prideful people on a warning when he came. People who think that they made it all by themselves and that they don't need God. People who don't want to be bothered with all the sad stuff going on, the struggling people all around them because it's too depressing. They insulate themselves from struggling people so they don't have to see the hardship, and so it doesn't impinge upon their comfort. You know, sometimes prideful people will say with a self-righteous, arrogant kind of way, you know, I climbed to the top of my profession, to the top of where I am. Stop all that whining, those of you who aren't there. Those of you who are struggling, get your boots on, climb the ladder like I did. What's the matter with you people, right? But in this verse, God sets himself in opposition to the proud. I was in a canoe with Chase one time on a small lake at a family farm in Minnesota. We were on the other side of the lake and the wind kicked up and blew against us as we were trying to return home. Now, I'm a pretty strong guy. I couldn't move that little boat an inch with that wind opposing us. And that's a picture of what life is like for the proud. A prideful life is a battle that none of us can win because God opposes the proud. And if you've allowed an ounce of arrogance to come into your spirit or an ounce of hardness in your heart toward the marginalized people, I would ask that you would humble yourself before God, and he will begin a new work in your life this Christmas time. You know, one of the great antidotes of pride is serving others. And there are so many causes of justice and mercy in our time. There are issues related to hunger and food scarcity, homelessness, abortion, abuse and oppression of women and of children, of the elderly, and foster care and adoption, and immigrants, and lack of fair wages and working condition, and the plight of single parents and widows and orphans, and water shortages, and lack of education, lack of proper medical care, and slavery and human trafficking, and loneliness and corruption in our prison and justice systems. I said at the beginning of this message that the prophets, like Micah, they were the ones who noticed. That they're the ones who saw what God saw and felt what God felt. And my heart this month is for us as a church, for us as individual believers, to notice. You know, when Jesus was here on this earth, where did he walk? Did he walk among the elite, among the rich and powerful? No. He walked among the poor. He walked toward the dark places, not around them like I'm inclined to do. And so if you follow Jesus, you will walk among the poor. Why? Because Jesus will lead you there. That's where he walks. Walk humbly with your God. And so for a moment, I want you to think about all the people that you walk by, all the people who aren't affected, who are affected by the stories on the news or the headlines on your news feed, the invisible people. What would it look like to consider their interests, maybe even above your own, like Jesus did? So by way of application, today's been just more of an introduction, but by way of application today, I want you to ask God one question. What's my assignment? You know, 2 Chronicles 16:9 says, "For the eyes of the Lord, they search the entire earth to find those, to strongly support those whose hearts are fully committed to him." And one of the reasons that we ask you to regularly find your chair, to surrender yourself to Christ every day, to get in quietness, into solitude, is so that you can listen to God. Because my hope is that you would keep yourself so dialed in to God that if it would ever please him to search the world, that his eyes would roam the earth and to give a special assignment to somebody, that he could give that assignment to you. It'd be a dream of mine if every person at Grace would get an assignment each week from God. It doesn't have to be a big one, but just some kind of special justice or mercy assignment, because you fit the description of that Chronicles passage, where you were just fully committed to God, and God knew that he could trust you with an assignment. And so ask God, what's your justice and mercy assignment this week or this month? And over the next couple of weeks, we're going to have the opportunity to act on these phrases, to act justly, to love mercy. And we're going to ask hundreds of you next week, for example, to help those in prison all across Pennsylvania to give gifts to their family for Christmas. We're also going to provide a number of other opportunities. In fact, there's more information on a page in your bulletins today. It looks something like this. So that you can come prepared to accept an assignment next week or the week after if God prompts you. Also, if you're a life group leader, you receive some information in your monthly email or on your coach's online bulletin board, because we'd love every life group and every individual at Grace to ask, what's my assignment? And so today, as we move into a time of communion at our physical locations, we go with humility on our minds, and we're reminded of our Savior, who is the ultimate picture of humility. Jesus died a criminal's death, but he was not a criminal. He looked not to his own interests, but to the interests of others. And so may this time remind us that we can walk in humility, because Jesus, our Savior, walked in humility.